temperature's rising.
Mine too. I need some loving.
You're such a fool. Folks, you're listening to The Drew Marshall Show. Thank you for tuning in. We are streaming live at drewmarshall.ca, on joyradio.ca, and across the GTA on AM 1250. So glad. Yeah, I am. That's how I feel about Will. I'm so glad he made it out of the cult, right?
Nicely played.
Eli, well done, son. Well done, son.
Thanks, Dad!
From executive producer Jared Leto, Holy Hell was a huge hit at the Sundance Film Festival. Just out of college, here's what they said at the Sundance page. I just copied and pasted it.
Nice.
Will Allen, a young idealist filmmaker, joined a secretive spiritualist community led by a charismatic guru. With his camera in hand, he documented 20 years of living inside a cult that changed how he would see the world forever. Will Allen recorded everything, offering us a juicy, unparalleled look, I love the word juicy, into the extreme ideals and expectations that make up this community, born out of Los Angeles, the city of cults. Wasn't it the city of angels? Did I miss that?
Yeah.
Okay. From total devotion turned to paranoia, the cracks began to unfold as unexpected truths were revealed about the enlightened leader they built every fiber of their lives around. For the first time, Will Allen turns the camera on himself and asks fellow ex-cult members to come to terms with their past and the unbelievable deceit they experienced. Holy Hell leaves us with many burning questions, but ultimately this one. What are we willing to believe to sustain our greatest happiness? The website, holyhellthedocumentary.com, holyhellthedocumentary.com, and joining us from the L.A. area in a secret underground bunker, Will Allen. How you doing, man?
How did you know I'm in my secret apartment?
I know. I know how you people in L.A. live. They're all bunkers. They are.
There's no windows, nothing.
Nope, that's it. Well, since you and I spoke recently, I've done a little bit of research, and how you are functioning today as somewhat even of a normal human being is beyond me. And I mean that gently and kindly. I tend to be too much of a jokester. I find humor in just about everything, and that gets me in a lot of trouble. But I mean this seriously, Will. Like, there's got to be some PTSD.
Yeah. Well, there is. This is what we're all working through. Anyone reintegrating into society after any kind of isolating experience, be in a group or even an abusive marriage, there's PTSD. There's trauma that's involved in the body and emotions, mind, everything.
Man. Okay. Well, you know, I know you've told the story a million times, so let's get through the meat and potatoes of this and get on to dessert. If I get this right, you know, you graduate school, it's sort of in the time in the 80s where, especially in the West Coast, people were really disillusioned. And of course, the East Coast were busy making money. You guys, where did you grow up? Are you from out there?
I was born in California. I had a very healthy family, Italian mother. My father was a corporate attorney. We lived near the beach when we were, you know, when I was 10 years old.
Yeah.
Very privileged life. But part of that created a disillusionment for me. I saw that there was lacking in society. I saw a lot of lack around me, even though there was money around me. So I had a spiritual quest since I was a young child, I think.
Okay, how do you define enlightenment?
Unattainable. Okay. Unrealistic. If there is such a thing, that means everything comes to a certain point, and nothing ever really does come to a certain point, so there's no such thing, because everything keeps expanding, so there's no such thing.
Right. So, you get introduced to this group through, is it your sister? No, who introduced
you? My sister was like my caretaker as a child. Like, she was 5 years older than I was, and she had met the teacher and this group of about 30 people in L.A., and when I got out of college, she just really could not wait to introduce me to them, and I was ready for something different. I'd been raised Catholic. I was, you know, I had no real direction with my life yet, and I walked into this room full of meditating people, and I had never seen anything like it before, and I was open.
See, first time I walked into a room of meditating people, I walked out.
Well, you know, a lot of people walked out. You know, you're right. But I remember when she dropped me off at the house, she said, they're going to be meditating. And I thought to myself, okay, well, I didn't have any negative connotation with meditation. Mm. You know, I was 22, it was 1985. And, you know, I had read Shirley MacLaine's Out on a Limb. And that was the most exposure I had to anything New Age or metaphysical.
Yeah.
And I was not judging it. I was open. I mean, yeah.
At what point were you the happiest? You know, you guys use the phrase blissed out a lot.
Yeah, that's a good question. I was happiest at the very, very, very beginning. I mean, I think the contrast that happens when you step into something like this, out of something else and into something new, the contrast is so huge that I experienced such bliss and joy and happiness and freedom from who I thought I was. That's from the community, from meditating, from the teachings we were practicing, which were Eastern-based. So I just experienced a lot of growth, and, you know, things fell away that were bothering me, and new things opened up for me that were joyful. So I was embracing all that. I loved it.
This is a weird time to ask this question, but I'd like to kind of get the answer before I move on to something else. In your entire life, Will, who has hurt you the most?
That's a good question. It's a hard question. We've all don't escape childhood without some kind of trauma. I think I cried a lot as a child. I think I felt very confined in my family situation in Newport Beach, and I always felt misunderstood and hurt. I think by my whole family structure, you know, even though we were loving, I felt like I was miscast, you know, at some point in my life coming out, growing up, teenager. So I think I got hurt by my family structure without, you know, blaming any one person.
Yeah, I guess then that means you were looking for a new family, not necessarily to replace your family, but when you found the family aspect of this cult, I mean, that was the thing that really grabbed you. It felt like family was supposed to feel for you.
It did. It felt like home. I could communicate. I could talk to anyone and everyone, and I could listen to other people, and there was no judgment. There was no expectation on them, and I had some unconditional love coming back to me, which is kind of what we want our family to be. And our family is unconditional love. We're bound by blood. But we also have expectations on each other, and we want people to perform a certain way for you. I had that with my mother and father, of course. And they're from a different generation than I was, and I couldn't connect with them.
Will, what was the first moment that your head turned sideways and you just kind of realized, you know, you had a check in your spirit about this group, about this new family of yours?
Yeah, that happened without spoiling too much of the movie, but, you know, there was sexual exploitation that happened with the teacher against our willingness and against my better judgment. And the moment that happened, my spiritual journey shifted. The moment those boundaries were crossed, which I had no idea what was happening, I didn't know any kind of trauma. I didn't relate to it as trauma at the time because I was so deep involved in this thinking. That was when it shifted inside of me. I mean, everything changed. I became angry for the rest of the time. And I couldn't talk to anyone about what happened to me, and made it more isolated and controlled by him.
Did you have family and loved ones outside of the group that maybe noticed a change in you, or they were leery about the whole thing, and maybe they said to you on numerous occasions, "Dude, what are you doing? Get out of this."
Well, my mom and dad were the only ones who did that, because all of my other two siblings were involved at the beginning. But when my one sister, Crystal, she was the most rebellious one. She got out in 3 years, and she was like, "This is bull." She saw all the lies. I couldn't see all that because I was really looking at the good stuff, and I was very close to all the good stuff happening. Mm-hmm. But she was very much adamant that this was bad for us. But my other sister and I stayed. And my mother and father would say stuff to us, and we would just hide. I mean, we had so many lies that we did to protect the teacher that no one really could say anything to us.
Yeah, yeah. Folks, you are listening to The Drew Marshall Show, and we're on the line with Will Allen. He's a former cult member and filmmaker, and the film is called Holy Hell. You know what? I was having a conversation the other day with somebody about this. You tell me what you think about this phrase. Grace trumps karma.
Well, that's funny. In our group, we used to laugh that the teacher would basically point out that if something was going bad in our life, it was karma. But if something was going well, it was his grace.
Oh, wow.
So it's a convenient twist on words, grace or karma.
Yeah.
I think there's cause and effect with everything. I think we're part of our co-creation with our life. So, I mean, we're responsible for more than we realize.
What do you miss most about Francesco?
Oh, how sweet and simple he was.
And the background of that question, folks, is that was the name that the leader gave you.
Yes. Uh-huh. He changed my name from Will to Francesco. He changed my sister's names as well. That was something he did to help us remove ourselves from our past identity and kind of free ourselves from any past associations. And it's a kind of Hindu thing that happens, you know.
Yeah.
Gurus can do that and change your name. But mine was Francesco for 22 years. And when I got out of the group, I didn't know what my name was. I couldn't keep that name, and I didn't associate with Will anymore because I had successfully compartmentalized him out of my experience. And so I had to reintroduce Will, which was kind of my child self, myself, back into the picture.
Mm-hmm. How are you different now? What's different about, this is what I'm interested in, is the contrast between who you are now as compared to who you were before you joined the cult, and the contrast to, you know, as to who you are now and who you were when you were in the cult.
Well, that's a good question. I didn't know who I was before. I got in the group, and after I got out of the group, I was very confused, and I felt like everything good about me came from those 20 years, like all the good qualities I cultivated in myself. And I called a girlfriend of mine who was knew me in college and loved me, like she's like my soul twin mate. And I said, was I good before this whole thing happened to me? You know, because I thought I had to give all the credit to the teacher. That was my brainwashing. And she's like, absolutely, you were amazing before this whole thing happened. And so that self-confidence was taken from us, you know, that we had before we got into the group. It was just kind of stripped from us. Coming out of the group, I would say I've had to reintegrate into the world, which is a little more, you know, people have lots of different ways of living, and we were living in a kind of controlled environment with a controlled groupthink, and outside it's not like that. So I think I've gotten a tougher skin. I've had to grow up, you know, give up my idealist personality a little.
Does that bug you? Does that bug you?
No, I want that, but I also want it to be easy, right? You know, we want to have a joyful life, and everyone does, I think. And we want it to be stress-free. So, but I've taken on this project, which is taking 4 years, and it was very stressful. And I do want to live simply as well. There's joy in that.
How have other members reacted to you releasing this film? Are they bugged? Because this group is still going. He's now called, where is the God King, by the way? What's the name he's going by now?
Yeah, Rachi, which is two words put together from Spanish and Indian. It's God and Revered One, or King, I'm sorry, King and Revered One. He's living in Oahu right now, in a small part of the island called Lanikai. That's what I've heard.
How many members would he have now?
Well, you know, that's really hard to find out because they kind of go underground and disperse, and they befriend each other on Facebook and stuff. It's hard to keep account unless you're part of it. But I heard that, you know, I heard it's about 100 and dwindling now because people are doubting and wondering what's going on. We want to get the movie to the island so they can see it, but he's spinning it in his own way to serve his own needs like he used to do, and preventing his people from seeing it, and they're believing him, and you know that's what we used to do. We used to believe everything he said.
So, have you had any members, ex-members, or current members reach out to you since releasing this film, Holy
Hell?
Yeah,
absolutely. We've had ex-members who left the group, very very supportive. We've had a couple who aren't supportive because they don't want this story to be told. And then the people with him. Well, you know, one of my cast members lives over on the island, and he had a physical death threat come to him from one of the members who I've never met before. He's a yoga teacher. He's in my film. And he's always in this constant turmoil with the group because he tells everyone in society what he knows about them because he was with them for 28 years. So they hate him, and someone came and gave him a death threat in public. And he went to the police, and they reported it. So... And it turns out the guy who did it lives at the same house that the teacher lives at. So it's all very connected. It's all very repeating. It's part of my film. He did that in my film. He's doing it again. Hmm. It's a problem with extreme kind of religions like this. No one's trying to kill anybody. We're just talking.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Can you just tell me more about Michelle, Andreas, God King, I don't know, whatever we're calling him. I mean, he's got to have some good qualities. You know, whenever something evil, the most evil that I've ever experienced has a nice candy-coated outside. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. I'm learning that. He drew from a lot of really great sources. And he was an actor, and he was talented, and he was a performer. You kind of had to know him and see him, and also give away a lot of your suspicion of belief when you get to know him, too, because he's a character. But it kind of fell in line with someone who says they're enlightened, they're kind of unorthodox and crazy, so you kind of can't put him in a box anyhow. That was part of our forgiveness factor. But he was very charismatic, and like I said, he memorized and borrowed from teachers' books, and he pulled what he wanted from every religion that he thought was valid and made it his own. So we were getting some of the best teachings from a variety of different, you know, cultures, I think, mm-hmm. and as a way of living our life, you know.
So did you fall in love with him because he was charismatic?
No, I think I fell in love with him as my mentor. I think he encouraged us to fall in love with him as a divine mentor who can help you get to where you want to go. But you had to trust him. You had to, and he was that person helping you. And it was almost like free. It was like, I'm helping you for free. I'm just giving this to you. And so you felt very obligated to give back and to be thankful all the time. I think we all fell in love with him, men and women, because we were in love with the words and his ability to share with us something that touched our hearts, right?
Okay. I like to, you know, this is theater of the mind. It's radio, so we don't have the privilege of the benefit of watching the documentary in front of us. By the way, how do we watch the documentary?
Right now, it's actually in theaters, a limited release in Los Angeles, in New York, in Austin. Actually, we're not in New York anymore, but other theaters coming up in different states. But you can go to holyhellthedocumentary.com, and we have listings. We should have the trailer on there. We have where we're going to be showing, and we're also going to be on iTunes soon.
Good.
And we're going to be on CNN at the end of in September.
Okay.
And we'll be on Netflix as well.
Oh, good. I'd like to see this at the Toronto Film Festival. I mean, come on. Why didn't you think of Toronto? You went to the Sundance one. Come on, yeah, Toronto.
Drew, yes. You were at Hot Docs about a month ago.
Oh.
In Toronto, that was Hot Docs, which is the Doc Festival international debut. So we did do that.
Okay, I guess I missed it.
I love Toronto. I just have to say, it was my favorite. It was such a fun festival for me. I love Toronto. I want to go back. I mean,
yeah.
Really liked people there.
So let's go through the leaving process. In just a little while on our show, we are going to be having Ron Miscavige. He is the father of the leader of Scientology, David Miscavige. And Ron Miscavige left. He really escaped Scientology 4 years ago. So we'll hear from him in a little bit. But what's your escape story? I mean, did you have to sneak away, or did you just kind of say, I'm out of here, and they had a nice little goodbye ceremony for you, and then you took all the movies?
Well, that's part of the film. The film kind of built to this climax, and that's part of the story, is how we got in and how we got out. So I'd love to leave that to the film, to tell that story. But I do want to say something about, I mean, I'll tell you really quickly, it broke up, and everyone kind of had the opportunity to finally communicate with each other, and those of us who were talking were able to come back to some critical thinking and get away. Mm. But we all did it together. The group kind of disseminated together. And that was really powerful because I don't think it was easy to get out alone. Like, you'll be talking to Ron, and very interesting, you know, it's very difficult to get out of something when everyone you know is in it.
Man, what do you think of religion? What do you think of monotheistic religions? What do you think of Jesus? Because here's the thing. You came out of something that you were immersed in. It was your identity for a very, very long time. And the number of people that I speak to over the years who get out of something, for example, Tal Bachman, yeah. who is a recording artist, he had a big song, big hit called She's So High. His father is Randy Bachman, Bachman Turner Overdrive, Taking Care of Business, blah, 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 blah. They were all Mormons. Tal did the research, found out that he discovered that what his belief system was not what he thought it was, and he left. And he is really reluctant to buy into anything else ever again.
Well, you have a heightened sense of awareness is what happens. You learn something. You learn a lesson. You're able to see something from far away in a way that it sometimes takes experience to earn those eyes to see. When I walk around now, when I see other religions, I worry that people are giving their power away to someone else, to someone else's thought, to someone else's belief system. And we do this as humans. It's like human condition. But we do need teachers. We do need institutions that can pass on knowledge. So how do you do this? I mean, I was walking, and our film was showing last night, and I was walking in the Santa Monica Promenade, and there are Hare Krishnas out there. And I really felt bad for them because they were all the age that I came, that I was when I came. Mm-hmm. And there was an older man kind of leading the dance, and I felt like my hands were tied. There was nothing I could do. Yeah. And I could see it all happening. I could see their background and why they're there and what they want. I understood it. But they're also losing their power when they think they're kind of gaining power. And so I started to film something. There was a woman who I thought was being recruited by one of the Indian Hare Krishnas, and I decided to film it. I got my iPhone out, and I wanted to film this recruitment happening, right? So I filmed it. I walked up right up to them, and I started filming it. And she turns to me and says, "Do you know Jesus loves you?" And I'm like, "Oh, you're recruiting him." I mean, these are two religions that are completely opposed, trying to convince the other person to come to their side. So how do I feel about that? I mean, I think there's a lot of confusion.
Yeah, that gives a whole new meaning to the to like a dueling banjo deliverance scene. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. Krishna, Jesus, Krishna, Jesus.
When I was watching some of the clips from your movie, Holy Hell,
mm-hmm.
there were moments that I recognized because having been part of the evangelical Jesus scene for so many years, I've seen shaking, I've seen crying, I've seen sort of trance-like behavior and falling down and looking like you're having a seizure. And they said that was God doing it. But it's very similar, the stuff that I saw in your documentary.
Right. Well, my question that I wanted to ask all my close friends, because that's what's so great about my film, is these are my friends. You know, these are people who will talk to me, and we've had conversations. But now our conversation goes deeper in hindsight, and it's like, I wanted to say to them, because I was sold that this is God, and I was sold that when I meditated, I was experiencing God. And I wanted to say, what makes you think it's okay to call that God? Like, where does that authority come that you can label that as what you think it might be? And it was a really hard question for people to answer because it always came back to, well, that's what I was told, or that's what I felt. I mean, it's nothing they can really substantiate. And so it's very unfortunate because this kind of gets passed on and passed on. Mm-hmm. And people are calling it.
It's tribal conditioning.
Yes, it is.
Exactly. And see, this is my challenge to the, and Tim, I want you as part of this segment of the conversation. This is our engineer, Tim the Tool. Tim, hello. this is Will.
Hey, Will.
Hi, Tim.
Tim, you and I, you know, grew up in the Jesus scene, and we've seen these sort of, and the Jesus people will call them manifestations of the Holy Spirit.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. so when those Jesus people see the same manifestations, how do they then not look at their own manifestation stuff and go, ooh, is that really of God? Or do they then go to Scripture and say, well, when the devil fools us, he does it in a way of mimicking what God would do, right? There's a verse that talks about
yeah.
that.
Jeez. I mean, that's you know, that could be a political question with the way that people talk and tell lies. You know, if I think like this person and that person, I think it stretches well beyond religion. But, you know, definitely, you know, if this gentleman, the God guy, whatever his name is.
The God guy. If no, he was, I think we're referring to him as God King right
God
now.
God King, sorry. Yes. If he was Tief and stuff from all sorts of religions, maybe.
He Tief the manifestation stuff.
Well, you know, was it pre-set up? Like I've heard in some cults things, you know, they pre-set things up and you do this when this happens. I'm not saying that it did, but.
You mean like at an auction where they have people who are planted yeah. in the crowd to raise the bids?
Yeah. No, that didn't happen here.
No.
Okay. There was a heightened sense of, like that scene, there's a scene in the movie where we're in the forest and we're all really walking around blind, touching nature. We're kind of into our senses, just touching things. And he would go up and start touching people on their forehead. And you're already in a very susceptible place. And I imagine you can experience something, they're experiencing something there, right? But at the same time, look back at who he studied, who he imitated most. It was a guru from India called Sri Bhagwan Rajneesh, or Osho. And Osho used to touch people on their Osho used to touch people on between their eyes. And so he saw them doing it, or him doing it, and must have decided he can do it, and just decided to start doing it. So the fact that he got any kind of results from people is a mystery.
Let me ask you, Will, should the law be involved in this? I mean, is he doing anything illegal? Because I don't think it's not a money thing, isn't it? I thought he came from privilege and it's not really a money thing.
Well, he's not extorting money, but he is making hundreds of thousands of dollars, off of his followers in therapy sessions, which he calls healings. And that is illegal. According to Sam Brower, who I talked to, who did Prophets Pray and brought down Warren Jeffs with the FLDS, talked to me. He said the fact that this teacher now is calling what he does with people in private healings and charging them for it, that's illegal in our government. That's illegal. They protect citizens from false healers who claim to be doing something they can't prove because people give money to them and they die or whatever. It's false. It's snake oil.
Okay, but Will, what do you say to those people who watch the movie, hear your story, and this is their response? And you've heard this before. They're going to say this. Well, if you're going to be dumb enough to believe this stuff, that's on you. How does that make you feel?
Well, we lived with that one for a long time. I think that's why we made the movie, because it's not black and white. And we were raised in our little society. We did take responsibility for everything we did, and that's kind of why we ended up staying there for so long. We were ashamed of allowing these things to happen and how we had to come back into ourselves and stuff. But there's also a message and a lesson there that's valuable, and I'm not going to disvalue my life, I learned a lot, and I learned a lot from the negative stuff. So that kind of comment's kind of ignorant only because it doesn't include the whole picture.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Everyone does. I'd like to look in your wallet and see what you were doing, 20 years ago and put your pictures on the screen and have a giggle,
Yep.
Because whoever you were hanging out with, I'm sure you question it now.
Sure. Maybe. Oh, yeah. No, you're right on. You're right on with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim's already laughing at me.
Yeah, because it was probably me
that I was hanging out with.
Yeah.
With a mullet haircut, right?
Yeah, baby. Wait a minute. How did he know you had a mullet haircut?
Because we're children of the '80s, my brother.
Oh, man. And we had puffy shirts.
Yeah.
And we tucked our shirts in, and we had belts on.
Yes.
Yeah.
I know, right?
Oh man. Well, Will, I wish, there's a part of me that's going to sound like a jerk here because I'm not going to be selling your movie nicely when I say this, but I actually don't give a holy grunt about the movie. I care more about your healing from all of this. I feel that the mountain in front of you that you need to climb up and over or get through or whatever kind of analogy we want to talk about here, dude, you've got a lot of stuff to process, and I wish you the best in your pursuit of peace.
Thank you. Thank you.
I will
take that. I will take that best wishes. I'll take all the best wishes. But the hard part's over for me. I mean, coming back in and owning this and talking about it has been the third chapter of this three-part journey, I think, Joseph Campbell talks about the hero's journey. You embark on a journey. You go into the journey where you battle your demons and your patriarch father, and you come back, in society, and you share with everyone else what you experienced. And there, like I said earlier, there's value in that, and I'm trying to allow that to be something that's important to me now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wish you the best, and folks, keep an eye on this movie. Find it on iTunes eventually, right?
Amazon.
We're gonna get Netflix.
iTunes.
The whole thing. It'll be everywhere.
We really love that it can include all audiences of different ages on the story because it's relatable in different ways, not just spiritually.
And here's the thing, it's incredible footage. I mean, it's insider footage, right? It's not just dramatic, what do they call
reenactment.
It? Reenactment, yeah.
No, there's no reenactments, we used a couple pieces of news footage and everything else is authentic footage.
HolyHellTheDocumentary.com, that's the website. Will, you've given us an enormous amount of time. Thank you so much.
Drew and Tim, thank you guys. Really nice. I like your questions a lot.
All right. Take care, man.
Okay. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye, Will. Oh, can you imagine, you wake up 20-something years later and you go, wow, everything I believed in for 20 years is just...
Well, you went through that.
Yeah.
Maybe yours is a little different because yours isn't labeled a cult, but...
No, I think I shut down the cult aspect of what I thought, or the tribal conditioning.
Okay, yeah, I think that's a fair way to say it.
But I mean, from what I get, they really saw this guy as their god. You know, not literally, maybe. I don't know. I'm not real quite sure on that. But then they'll all of a sudden wake up and go, he's actually just an ex-porn star.
Yeah. Well, you know, it happens all over the place. You know, David Koresh and Waco, and needless to say, again, you know, the Nike-wearing people with the hell bop.
I'm sorry, what was the brand of shoes there,
Nike,
Tim?
Nike, Adidas, I can't remember. Maybe we should get them as a sponsor.
The Birkenstock-wearing.
Yes, you know, and then as you mentioned, Jamestown, you know, James Jones, all of that stuff. These people believed that they were a prophet, maybe slightly above a prophet, maybe not quite God, but definitely way above them, and they put all of their trust, some to the point of death, and luckily people like him have gotten out.
Gives me the shivers.
Yeah.
How are you, Tori?
I'm good. How are you?
Listen to that voice. You're kind of sweet, aren't you?
Only sometimes.
I've heard. Tori, can you tell the world about something?
Of course I can.
Please.
So maybe you've been thinking about advertising your organization on the radio, but don't really have the budget for a long-term marketing campaign. Well, what if we gave you an entire show? The Drew Marshall Show is currently offering an innovative and affordable advertising concept for small business owners.
Huh.
With web stats and listenership at an all-time high, mm-hmm. Canada's most listened to spiritual talk show is offering you an opportunity to partner with us for an entire show.
Say it's not so.
Become a one-day advertising partner, and we'll introduce you to our listening audience for the day. Drew will mention your organization every hour during our four-hour show.
That's four times.
And we'll give you a live five-minute phone interview. Oh, and one more thing.
Yes?
We'll also post your logo and website link on our website for an entire month.
No!
So, if you're thinking about promoting a special event, product, or upcoming sale, or if you just want to test the radio advertising waters without a huge investment, then consider becoming a one-day advertising partner with the Drew Marshall Show.
That's a good idea.
Contact us through our website, drewmarshall.ca, and ask about becoming a one-day advertising partner.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tori the intern on the Drew Marshall Show. Very well done. She gave us a little head snap and a thank you. Well, she just got back from somewhere.